this fort is called the Bahia Sutta, and it actually goes back to an incident in the life of the Buddha. And as you might have heard, at the time of the Buddha's life, there were many contemporaries, there were other, of course there was already an existent religion. Brahmanism was very widespread and new groups were emerging all the time. There's a Jainism. Mahavira was the founder of the Jain tradition, was a contemporary of the Buddha. And there were many ascetics and wanderers who would just, you know, wander through India, living on alms probably, just like the Buddha's Sangha did. And sometimes they came for discussions and debate and even challenging and so forth. And this particular man, his name is Bahia, of the bark cloth, actually. It's a kind of funny name. And I guess it probably refers to him maybe wearing a garment made of bark. So I would imagine that, something like that. Because as knowing India, you find people with the strangest outfits, still nowadays, walking the streets. And so he was a very respected spiritual practitioner, let's call him like that. And he lived by the seashore, I guess it was in the... is it called the Bengal Sea? Yeah, the Bengal Sea. We know where Calcutta is, a little further south, a little bit further down south. And was very much revered and honored and so forth, had a large following. And then one day the thought occurred to him, I wonder if amongst all the ascetics and teachers in this world, I am one of the arahants, the awakened ones. He was having that question. I mean, that already shows that you know, it couldn't be true. And he didn't get an answer, but then, as so often in the Buddhist scriptures, a deity manifested, actually a deity who used to be a relative of his, now residing in some kind of heavenly realm. And this deity overheard what Bahia was thinking and manifested itself in front of him and said, "Well, Bahia, you are not one of the arahants, of the awakened ones. You're not even one who is on the path to awaken. You don't even practice what is conducive to awaken the heart." And so, of course, that was a very sobering message which Bahia got, but he took it to heart. You know, didn't dismiss the devata and say, "Oh, you don't know anything. You're just living up in heaven and, you know, fooling around up there." No, he took it very seriously, and then he asked the devata, "Well, then if I'm not someone, well, is there someone around who is like that, who is an arahant, a fully accomplished one?" And then this devata said, "Yes, there is. There's someone living in Savatthi in northern India, so it's about 1,200 miles away from that seashore, in Jetavana, in this monastery, and he's called the Buddha. He's the one, he's an arahant, he's fully accomplished. So you could seek him out." And so Bahia took him Devata by the word, and then he made his way to Savatthi. It's a kind of very interesting little phrase where it mentions that he did this in one night. He did the whole journey in one night. So, and of course the scholars are still arguing if it really was one night or it meant just one night at the time. And he might have had some, you know, psychic powers and just being able to, you know, transfer large distances with a snap of a finger. Anyway, he appeared in Savatthi eventually and went straight to Jetavana, the monastery where the Buddha was living. And when he arrived there, you saw a group of monks. They were doing what we were doing. They were doing walking meditation. And it was in the morning, I think. And then Bahia went straight up to the monks and, "I am Bahia," and so forth. "And I'm really very keen to meet your teacher, the accomplished one, the awakened one. I've heard about him. Could I please see him?" And the monk said to him, well, it's not possible right now. The Buddha is on alms round right now. He's going for alms in the village in Sawati. So Bahia said, well, okay, but it's very urgent, it's very important, very urgent. I have to see him today, you know, very, very soon. So he actually said, thank you very much for the information. He went straight out to Sawati in order to search for the Buddha, whilst the Buddha was on alms round. And sure enough, after a little while, he saw a row of monks walking there, very composed. You know these, if you've been to Asia, you know these rows of monks going on alms. And usually the senior monk goes in front, so the Buddha was in front of this row of monks, very composed and mindful, as Buddhas do. But Bahia went straight up to him, threw himself to the floor, very respectful, and addressed the Buddha and says, please, accomplishment, please, venerable, could you give me a concise teaching, your way of teaching, which leads to the accomplishment of arahantship? And the Buddha said, Bahia, he must have introduced himself, Bahia, this is not the right time, we're going on alms right now, not the right time to ask such a question. But then Bahia persisted, he said, well, you know, Venerable, don't think that I'm impolite, but you never know what's going to happen, you know. It's happened. Something could happen to me, something could happen to you, and then this will be unresolved. So I have to know now, please give me just, in a nutshell, give me your teaching. And the Buddha said, Bahia, this is alms round time. I'm not giving discourses on alms round time. So he thought, let it be settled then, but Bahia was very persistent. He repeated and said, please, Lord, be so kind and give me your teaching, because we never know what's going to happen. We could both die any instant, and then this occasion, this opportunity will be missed. So then the Buddha, and as you know, when Buddhas are asked three times, they have to answer wherever it is. And I thought I'd read this out to you, because I don't want to give my version of it, because it's very beautiful, actually. One of the most beautiful teachings the Buddha gave, and very concise teaching also. So that's why I printed it out here. And so the Buddha didn't say, okay, Bahia, no. You can't twist the Buddha's arm, of course. You cannot do that. But he was thinking, well, okay, this seems to be really where we're at now. He's so persistent, so I give him the teaching in a nutshell. He said, then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. And in reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. So Bahia, when for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, and only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. And when there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this Bahia, is the end of stress, the end of dukkha. So that was the nutshell teaching. You got it? Anyone? So, of course, this year, this way of putting it, Bahia, when you see, you know, it's in reference to the senses, what we perceive through the senses, and also what we perceive through our cognitive mind, when you can leave, thinking, of course, and you just leave it as that. Or maybe as, you know, in the way I tried to put it this morning, to allow things to just simply be as they are, no additive, then there's no you there, so means then there's no, first there's no you in connection with that. So that means you don't identify with these processes, either with individual occurrences through one of the senses or through the whole of it, through the whole thing, and call this is me, this is who I am, you know. This is what we call, in another parlance, we call it to take identity. Huh? We take identity in these things, in these happenings as they occur. And then in the second phrase, when there's no you in connection with that, there is no you there. So when you realize that there's no you there, that's meaning you don't take identity, you haven't taken identity. So there is no, you know, there's no more need to kind of identify yourself or call yourself a person on the basis of these perceptions and these the awareness of the thinking process. Then this whole theme of attachment to a sense of self is resolved. Huh? We could call that the realization of anatta, of non-self. That all experiences, as they occur, they cannot be attributed to an independent, autonomous self. And of course, admittedly, that is, for most people, quite a nut to crack. It is the nut. It is the nut in Buddhism. But nevertheless, we shouldn't feel shy to approach that. Because if we don't even approach that, we miss out on the most important aspect of the Buddha's teaching. And so then, the last sentence, then when there is no you there, you're neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. So, self-identity, an autonomous self, and so forth, whatever you want to call it, it cannot be found. There's nowhere to be found. It's just ongoing processes, ongoing events, and we perceive them carefully, mindfully, and we're not grasping at them, we don't attach to them. We don't become whatever is the result of the perceptions and impressions which we receive. We don't become that. Huh? I think I said it last night, and if you were there, that there's a strong tendency that we actually become that what we perceive and invest emotional energy in. We become even reborn into that. You could go that far and phrase it like that. That for a moment we are reborn in an experience of desire, or in an anger flush, or in a contraction of fear. We get reborn into that. At least for a few moments we think, this is all we are, who we are. I mean, we don't really think that because it's absurd, but we have the impression that that's our reality at that moment. It's like that. Mm-hmm. So that's why this is very important, because that's obviously suffering, that is stress. When we take this kind of rebirth, you know, this kind of moment-to-moment rebirth, then we do suffer, and we just go in circles because we keep reconfirming old habits which we have created over our lifetime, and maybe based on, you know, things which have gone on before that, and there's no way out. Then we'll just go round and round and round and round, as they say, the circle or the cycle of samsara is endless. It just keeps turning and spinning as long as greed, hate, and delusion are on the hub of it and keep it in motion. Huh? Those three toxins are the driving force of samsara, and they drive us round and round and round until the heart is released, and then this is finally finished. So maybe just to the story is not ended, actually. and I can tell you what happened without reading it. What then happened, Bahia, of course, was very grateful from this... not only grateful for this discourse, he was immediately awakened. He was released through listening to this word, or these words of the Buddha. And as you might have heard, there's not the only one, actually, in the scriptures. There are quite a few instances where people at least get the what they call the stream entry, you know, reach the first level of awakening by just listening to a discourse. And this one here, Bahia, he shoots all the way through all the four levels, become a fully awakened one. So obviously he must have done some good work before. I must think he can't be. Maybe the Devata was exaggerating a little bit, speaking to him, just to spur him on, you know. So Devata would have said, "Oh, you're very close, you know. You just need a little nudge and then you've got it, you know." He might have just gone, "Oh, go on, take it easy, you know. So don't have to maybe put too much effort in." But because the Devata dismissed Bahia's accomplishments, says, "You're not even on the way to awakening," he was really keen. "I really need to know now. I have to find the answer to this riddle." And so then he was released from the effluence, as it says here, the asavas in the text. No more clinging was perceived. And then, of course, the Bahia said, "Thank you very much," and left the Buddha. But then what happened, interestingly, as he walked away, just a few minutes after, he was encountering a cow with its calf. And cows can be very vicious when they have calves, like any animal wanting to protect its offspring. So the cow poked Bahia in his belly, and Bahia died on the spot. So Bahia's intuition was right, actually. When he went to the Buddha and said, "You know what's going to happen? You never know, you know, you could die, I could die, and then this opportunity is missed." So this stray, was not a stray cow, it was just an ordinary cow in India as they walked the streets there, and killed it. And then the monks saw what has happened, and so they asked the Buddha, "What shall we do with the body of Bahia?" And the Buddha said, "Well, take this body, cremate it, and take the ashes and erect a little monument for him." So because Bahia was an accomplished one, he was fully awakened. So as you know, this tradition of building stupas and pagodas, it goes way, way back in Indian history, usually reserved. Well, I'm not sure actually where it originated. Was it in the worldly sphere with worldly rulers, or was it in the spiritual sphere? But it happened in both. On both sides there were monuments erected for important kings, but then, especially in the Buddhist traditions, they were erected for accomplished monks. You would have these little stupas built. You can see them all over Asia, in Thailand, and Burma, and Sri Lanka, and so forth. So that's what the monks did. They burnt Bahia's body, and then erected this monument, and then went back to the Buddha, and then they were still curious. They paid respects to the Buddha and asked him, "You know, Lord, we have done as you said. We've burnt Bahia's body, erected the little monument, and we wondered, what is happening now, Bahia? Where is he? What is his destination now, as he has been killed by this cow, and apparently he was an arahant, so where is he going?" And then I should read out, because I really want not to miss on the Buddha's words here. "Monks, Bahia of the Baklo was wise. You practiced the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma and didn't pester me." Even the Buddha can feel pestered, apparently. "You didn't pester me with issues related to the Dhamma. Bahia of the Baklo, monks, is totally unbound." So unbound is a word for the heart is unbound. You could imagine unbound from the defilements, from the fetters. The heart is free. So it's a quite nice expression, rather than overusing the word enlightenment to speak about unbinding. The heart is unbound. This is actually a translation by Ajahn Tanisaro, so he likes to use this word anyway for awakening. And then actually the Buddha spontaneously uttered a little poem, which is very beautiful, I think. The Buddha said, on that occasion, "Where water, earth, fire and wind have no footing, there the stars don't shine and the sun is not visible. There the moon doesn't appear. There darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahman, through sagacity," I guess that's wisdom, just like sagesse in French, I guess, sagacity, very often used. So when a Brahman through sagacity has realized this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. So that is the realization of what we call the deathless. So they're very beautifully put. Huh? So we can listen to this, we can maybe have a sense for the beauty of this phrase, and then maybe the cognitive mind kicks in again, what is this? Can you say a bit more? Wants to know what this is pointing to. And I think this is enough, you know, it's pointing to something. We all intuit what it is pointing to. But it seems to be very often when we now would start to do further elaborations and further analysis what unbinding is, what the deathless is and so forth, we just get more and more confused again. But we have an intuition that this is pointing to something very profound. So it's going beyond the seeming opposites. Huh? There's no sun, there's no moon, there's no light, there's no darkness. And form and formless, beyond form and formless, bliss and pain and so forth. All these opposites are transcended. The freed heart has gone beyond all that. And so that is, of course, the point that the Buddha was made, so the heart can be freed in this particular way, going beyond all opposites. And that is called the deathless, or unbinding is one word, the deathless, which is, I guess, in English, but also in other languages, a strange term. If I say this in German, the equivalent, or in French, people always look a little puzzled when they hear it for the first time, because we all hear about death and life, huh? But we never hear about deathless. But deathless, actually, what that's pointing to is pointing beyond birth, life, and death. So deathless, if you don't, and as our teacher Ajahn Chah used to say sometimes flippantly to his disciples, if you don't want to die, if you're afraid of dying, don't get born. Because death is the result of birth. If you don't get born, you don't die. So do something that you don't get born again, then you won't die. As simple as that. Easy, isn't it? easy to understand. If it's easy to do, it's of course another question. And then, as we're speaking about these very sublime terms, there's another way of putting it is the realization of the deathless is also termed then the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated. So that, you know, all these words with un, where our mind just stops. What is that? We can think about the form. What is form? We have form everywhere. As soon as our gaze goes out, we're looking for form. And sometimes maybe a good teacher might point out, are you also aware of space? Which our teacher Ajahn Sumedho very often likes to do. Are you aware when you come into a room like this one, there's also space, actually more space than form, if you enter this room. But we are conditioned to always hone in on the form. You see the chairs, the pictures, the carpet, the people, everything is what is interesting for us is in the area of form. But then we can use also an awareness of space. And I must say here now, having spent these last 3 months in Canada, I really appreciated the space you have in this country. It's a very spacious country compared to the countries in Europe, Southern Europe and Central Europe anyway. It gets more spacious in the north in Scandinavia. But here, there seems to be so much space, and it's wonderful. I really enjoy that, you know, the spacious lake near the monastery, or just the drive across the countryside. And there's lots of vast expanses and hardly any buildings. You know, the eye just goes into, you know, maybe into the sky, into the distance. And so it's I usually have a very positive resonance with space. It doesn't threaten me. In fact, I really like it. There are people who find space too threatening. and kind of the cavemen or cavewomen of this world. They like to huddle up in some kind of tight space, lots of things around them. And in the monastic life, you get actually monks who love to live in caves, and dark caves even. I couldn't survive there. I'd probably shrivel up and die very quickly if you put me in a cave, in a dark cave. But in a place with spacious vistas, also of course where I normally or have been residing for many years, there's also a certainly from time to time the space element available, and I've also been contemplating it there when you're on a mountaintop or so, of course also that is wonderful expanse of space. And so then that also, of course, it's in resonance which comes from within, isn't it? So can we also then maybe take that inwardly, that sense of spaciousness? How do we feel inside? Does our heart feel spacious or cramped and tight and full of stuff, of thoughts and feelings and constant process commentary and analysis and sub-commentary and so forth? Or is there also space? Is there sometimes silence? Is there stillness available? And if there isn't, I really encourage you to cultivate that. And of course, part of the training is to develop calm. To develop calm is also the result of that is a stillness, experience of stillness in the mind. And when the mind is still, it feels spacious. We feel spacious inside. There's not one thing after the other occurring, and we have to deal with it, but we can just relax and enjoy the spacious nature of the mind. And this is another euphemism used in Buddhism, that if we speak in particular of the true nature of the mind, the true nature of the citta is spacious by nature. It is empty also. There's nothing in it. And that's not bad news. It's good news. It's empty in the sense of spacious, empty of self in particular. Empty of self. It's radiant. It's another aspect. True nature of the mind is radiant, spacious, and empty. And it has the limitless possibilities of manifesting. So these sublime ways of speaking about that towards which the teachings are pointing to. I don't know what that does with you. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit if you find this is within the scope of your practice, or if you find this is not something for you, you need to, you know, something more, at least on a daily level, something more hands-on. And I'm all for that, actually. I'm not someone who will encourage that we just sit here and have high-minded thoughts and high-minded ideas and cultivating Buddhist idealism and, you know, throwing in this sublime terminology at each other, but see this more, and I like really that term pointer, see this as pointers that point to something. These teachings are pointing to some. This is a reality there which can be realized. We can realize this in this very life, and it doesn't have to be postponed to another life. If we do the necessary steps, if we're willing to embark on the training, and the training, of course, encompasses quite a few aspects. It's not just one dimensional, one method, one technique. And as you know, this morning you've taken the precepts. Precepts is also very much just like body-based practice in meditation is a foundation, but the precepts are also the foundation for us to prevent that we're going into extremes, and extreme behavior with body, speech, and even mind, our thinking. So we have a certain constraint. And the good thing, the good result of that is that we don't have to remember horrible things which we've done or said, so that we kind of settle things already at the very rudimentary level. Huh? We don't have to kind of feel regret or remorse about a horrible thing we've done or said, but the space is cleared. And so, of course, if the space is cleared on that level, then when we sit down and meditate, we don't have to process all this stuff. You know? We don't have these memories, oh, it wasn't very good what I said there, or I wonder how she feels about this. You know how our minds can be occupied with all sorts of occurrences which just happened in our personal life a few hours ago, or yesterday, or last week, and so forth. And then comes to the practices of, as I said, bringing the mind to stillness, to calm, and so forth. And then using stillness and calm not to just disappear within it, using the Buddha's teaching as a tranquilizer. And we all know when we come out and go into after our daily business, this cannot be preserved. People will, and sometimes people get actually annoyed if you are like that, if you're too calm. They're going to test you if it's really genuine, you know, if it's really authentic, or if you're just kind of putting on a show as a good spiritual person. So we don't have to do such things, but nevertheless, the practice of calm stillness is important, but it is supposed to serve us to then deepen the quality of awareness, the attention we give to things, the panya factor, the wisdom factor, sagacity, as it's said here. This needs to be strengthened through all these different elements, so that we can, and that can be applied not only here in a relatively quiet environment, but also in daily life. Wisdom is not limited. In fact, it should be put to the test in daily life. If it doesn't work, is it completely turned off when we're going about our daily business? Something's not right. Something's unbalanced. It's unbalanced. So then we have to look into what is it. Maybe I'm holding on to something, some state, some experience, or some perception of myself as I should be like that, I should stay like that, it shouldn't change. And then we get threatened if situations come which do challenge us. And it will always happen, won't it? And this is, seems to be how life works, that we always seem to get the challenges which we need. Unless you're saying to yourself, no, it shouldn't. I shouldn't get the challenges which I need. People, life, society, my spouse, my children, my parents should give me a break and shouldn't pester me like the Buddha was saying. Like Bahia didn't pester him with questions, and so sometimes we demand that nobody should pester us any longer. Leave me at peace. I want my peace, nothing more. No, you can't go through life like that. This doesn't work. It doesn't lead to awakening. You can try and insist on it, that other people operate according to your wishes, or what you want to happen, what you can accept. But the world doesn't revolve around you. In fact, that's the typical perception of an egoic mind. As we all know, people are not only egoic, but egocentric or narcissistic, even worse. They think the world revolves around him or her. It's more often a him than a her. I don't want to mention any names, but that's certainly the case, that you find these very narcissistic beings. Huh? They think you can't really extend much beyond themselves. And that's a very sad affair if we have to witness that. But even those people who are still in a very kind of contracted and limited mind space, they can't look much beyond themselves, have no insight into their own self, personality, don't even feel the need to go beyond it. Why should they? They are, you know, the cat's whiskers, as they say in England. You know, I am so smart. And all the others come second. Well, they can do this for a time, but eventually they will also get their challenges where life presents them with lessons where they might also have to look at this. Of course, you can waste also a lifetime and you will not look at it in this life. And then the wheel of samsara will take care of it and give you another chance and another conditions so that eventually you do maybe get the point. You might have to spend a few aeons in purgatory and a few kalpas in hell in between, or in other realms of existence before you get the point. But I think for me that sounds rather depressing, you know, to have make such a long detour. I would prefer to really come to the point as quickly as possible. Almost quite that urgency as Bahia manifested when he went to the Buddha. Because who knows what happens? We could be hit by anything as we go out the door here and drive a car out in the street and boom, some big vehicle flattens us. Or we get the message from the doctor the next checkup that we have some serious problem there in our system. And those things are, of course, a little reinforcements, you could say, things to say, don't get complacent. There's no need to get agitated on the spiritual path, absolutely not, but don't get complacent either. Don't just sit back too much and just think that everything's happening by itself. It won't. It's not happening by itself. So it does need our participation. So to be able to allow things to be as they are, to accept things as they are, as easy as this might sound, it needs some supportive measures and skillful means to enable us to actually experience this in a very real way and not on the basis of wishful thinking. So this is what I want to say to this theme, just in addition to